On a Tuesday in November 1955, a Swanson TV dinner sat in an aluminum tray on a Long Island countertop, while I Love Lucy played in the next room. Turkey, gravy, peas, mashed potatoes, a small compartment of cornbread stuffing. 40 minutes from freezer to plate. The same household, a decade earlier, would have started a roast at 3 in the afternoon, peeled potatoes by hand, made gravy from the pan drippings, and shelled peas at the kitchen table. Both were dinner. Neither was a moral act. Between them sat about an hour, the hour the rest of this essay is about. That hour did not disappear. It was moved. Where exactly it went, and what it was paid for, is the story of convenience food. The supermarket aisle that lets a modern home cook serve dinner in 12 minutes contains the time, labor, and technique that used to live in the home kitchen. Relocated to a factory, a refrigerated truck, a grocery distribution center, a research lab in New Jersey. The same hour shows up on a balance sheet somewhere. It just no longer shows up on the cutting board. What was actually replaced? The temptation in writing about this period is to set scratch cooking on a pedestal and call the loss vague, a loss of tradition or domestic skill. That framing flattens the question. Scratch cooking was never a single thing. It was a stack of small daily practices that home cooks reached for without thinking about them as skills. Specifically, 4 kinds of intelligence did most of the work in a pre-convenience kitchen. The first was fat literacy, knowing what good rendered fat smelled like, what scorched fat smelled like, when to use cold fat for a crust and warm fat for a sauté, how lard differed from butter, differed from bacon drippings, differed from chicken schmaltz, and which fat carried which flavor. A 1940s home cook saved drippings in a metal can on the back of the stove and used them across half a week of cooking. The decisions were small but constant. The second was broth and stock instinct. The sense that the first water in a pot mattered, that bones simmered all afternoon would behave differently from bones simmered for an hour, that a finished stock should feel slightly sticky on the lip. The distinction between a stock and a broth, which most modern cooks have never had to make sharply, is the kind of distinction convenience food quietly flattens. See the quiet difference between stock and broth for the cleaner version of that vocabulary. These were not formal skills, they were daily defaults. The third was sauce by reduction, the practice of building a sauce from what was already in the pan. A pan sauce after roasting a chicken, a quick reduction from braising liquid, a small adjustment of salt and acid at the end. The cook learned the rhythm by watching the pan. The fourth was vegetable confidence. The cook's eye for what to do with whatever the icebox or garden had on Tuesday. Cut, season, cook, serve. The recipe was not in a book. It was assembled in real time from a small library of standard moves. None of these were heroic. They were the everyday substrate of cooking. When convenience products began absorbing them one by one, pre-rendered fats, canned broth, jarred sauces, frozen pre-cut vegetables, what changed was not the home cook's character. What changed was that the daily practice of those skills no longer happened. A skill that you do not practice fades, not because of any virtue, but because of how skill works. The industrial kitchen as a chemistry problem. To understand convenience food, it helps to look at the post-war industrial kitchen, the way the people building it looked at it, as a set of physical chemical problems with engineering solutions. Three frontiers were doing most of the work between roughly 1945 and 1970. The first was the cold chain, the continuous low-temperature corridor from factory to grocery freezer to consumer's home freezer. Refrigerated rail cars had existed since the late 19th century, but the post-war expansion of mechanical refrigeration in trucks, supermarket cabinets, and home appliances was what made frozen food a national consumer category. Clarence Birdseye's quick freezing patents from the 1920s and 30s, which produced small ice crystals that did less cellular damage than slow freezing, had been waiting for the rest of the infrastructure to catch up. By 1955, home freezers existed in roughly a third of American households, by 1970, in more than four-fifths. The second was emulsification chemistry. Margarine had been a marginal product until industrial hydrogenation of vegetable oils, standardized by mid-century, allowed manufacturers to produce a spreadable fat at predictable cost, predictable melting point, and long shelf life. Shortening, Crisco from 1911, then dozens of variants, was the baking fat companion. Industrial mayonnaise, with stabilized emulsions built around standardized lecithin and acetic acid ratios, became a national pantry default. The chemistry was real and interesting, a manufactured emulsion that did not break at warehouse temperature, did not separate during refrigerated transport, and did not require the cook to know anything about how an emulsion was held together. The chemistry of holding fat and water in a stable suspension is covered in the free guide, Fat and Emulsification. Atlas of Cooking Systems, Chapter 2. The third was dehydration and concentration. Instant coffee, powdered milk, dehydrated potatoes, bouillon cubes, powdered soups. The technology was old, spray drying dates to the 1850s, but the post-war consumer demand for shelf-stable products that reconstituted into something resembling dinner was new. By 1960, the Maggi-style bouillon cube, the Lipton-style dried onion soup mix, and the Campbell's condensed soup format had become not just products, but recipe ingredients. The 1950 Campbell's Soup Cookbook assumed a can of mushroom soup was a sauce base. By 1965, it was the basis of the green bean casserole, baked ziti, broccoli rice bake, a whole class of American home cooking built downstream of a single canned product. These three frontiers, cold chain, emulsion chemistry, dehydration, were not adversaries of the home cook. They were tools. The cook absorbed them. The question this essay asks is which daily intelligences they absorbed in turn. Five case studies. A few specific products carry most of the weight here because most of the industry was built around them. Margarine carried the fat literacy load. By 1955, it had passed butter in American per capita consumption. Driven by price, industrial vegetable oils were cheaper than dairy fat, by wartime butter rationing that had broken the home cook's fat default, and by advertising that positioned margarine as the modern choice. What margarine absorbed was the small daily decisions about which fat to use for which purpose. The fat in the tub did not need to be thought about. It melted predictably, held emulsions predictably, and made cakes that rose. The cook stopped noticing the fat. That is not a tragedy. It is what successful product engineering looks like. It is also why a modern home cook can be a confident baker without ever having reduced a brown butter to the moment the milk solids turn nutty. Shortening, Crisco from 1911 and its competitors, did the same for baking. A reliable, neutral-flavored, room-temperature solid fat that produced a tender pie crust without the cook needing to manage the temperature behavior of butter. The trade was real. More predictable results, less seasonal variation, no need to know how cold the dough should be at the moment of laminating. What atrophied was the eye for what butter does as it warms. Industrial mayonnaise, Hellmann's, Best Foods, dozens of regional brands, did something subtler. It standardized the texture of cold sauces. A 1930 home cook who made mayonnaise by hand learned, in the doing, the rhythm of drizzling oil into yolks. The moment of break, the recovery moves. By 1960, most American households bought jarred mayonnaise as a default. What was lost was not the ability to make mayonnaise from scratch. That could be recovered in 20 minutes from any recipe. What was lost was the daily training in emulsion behavior. The cook's wrist remembering the moment a sauce thickens and what made it happen. Frozen meals, Swanson TV dinners from 1953, then the entire frozen entree aisle, carried the integration problem. A whole dinner in one tray, designed to come out of the oven, later the microwave, at consistent doneness across components with very different thermal behaviors. A protein, a starch, and a vegetable do not naturally arrive at done at the same moment. The industrial solution involved gradient cooking, tray geometry positioning denser proteins toward the heat source, and elaborate moisture engineering, gravies designed to release water during reheating so the meat stayed moist, starches selected for behavior under freeze-thaw cycles, vegetables blanched before freezing to halt the enzyme activity that would otherwise produce off flavors at 12 weeks of storage. The deeper texture engineering vocabulary lives in the free guide, Moisture and Texture, Atlas of Cooking Systems, Chapter 3. None of this engineering was visible from the dining table. It was supposed to be invisible. Instant soups and bouillon cubes carried the broth load. The Maggi cube, dating to 1908 in Switzerland, but standardized globally post-war, was an industrially concentrated savoriness. Hydrolyzed vegetable protein, salt, monosodium glutamate, sometimes meat extract, designed to dissolve into hot water and produce something soup-shaped fast. The Japanese parallel arrived a generation later. Ajinomoto's Handashi, in 1970, reduced the kombu katsuobushi extraction to a powder you stir into water in 30 seconds. Both products did the same thing on opposite sides of the Pacific. They absorbed the daily practice of broth and dashi. The household no longer needed to plan an afternoon around bones and water, or a morning around kelp soaking. What the household traded was the felt sense of how a real stock behaves on the spoon, the slight stickiness on the lip that you only get from bone-derived gelatin. The dashi version of that intelligence is documented at Basic Dashi. What changed in texture and expectation? If you grew up eating convenience food, certain textures became your baseline for what dinner is supposed to feel like in the mouth. This part of the story is worth being specific about because it shapes a whole generation's palate without anyone naming it. A microwaved frozen entree has a gradient texture that nothing else produces. The outer layer is hotter than the inner. The starch is denser than from a fresh boil because freezing, gelatinized, and reset the granules. The gravy carries enough hydrocolloid stabilizer, modified starch, sometimes carrageenan or xanthan, to stay viscous as it cools at the table. The mouth registers this as moist, hot, slightly thick, evenly seasoned, uniform from bite to bite. That uniformity, the absence of moment-by-moment variation in a fresh-cooked plate, is what convenience food texture engineering is actually selling. The eater is not consciously seeking uniformity. They are seeking the absence of unpleasant surprise, which is what good food engineering provides. Batter coatings on frozen fried foods, fish sticks, chicken nuggets, breaded vegetables, do something similar. The coating is pre-fried, then frozen, then recooked at the consumer's oven. It is engineered to survive freeze-thaw, a low-moisture inner pre-dusting, a tempura-style middle batter, and a coarse breading outer layer that holds crispness despite ice crystals forming inside it. The eater experiences this as consistent crunch. The cooking system reader sees a careful piece of material science. These are not failures. They are precise solutions to the constraints the product was designed under. What is worth noticing is that they install a default palate. A child whose Tuesday dinners through the 1970s were Swanson Hungry Man entrees developed an expectation that gravy is thick, that meat is uniformly seasoned through, that breaded coating crunches the same way every time. None of those expectations are wrong. They are just different from the ones a child would develop from braised meat and pan gravy made twice a week, which involve much more textural variation, the occasional too salty bite, the occasional surface that is a little drier on one edge than the other. The convenience food palate is calibrated to a different baseline. That is not a fall. It is a calibration. But it is worth knowing it happened. What was gained? This is where the essay has to be honest, because the gains were real. Treating them as small is a mistake. The most concrete gain was time for caregivers. In 1950 American households, women performed something like 95% of meal preparation. The average daily time spent on cooking and cleanup was approximately 3 to 4 hours. The Japanese figure was similar. By 1990, the daily figure had dropped to roughly 1 to 1.5 hours, with a meaningful redistribution of that time toward, in many households, paid work, childcare, sleep, or any of the other things a person might do with 3 hours. The convenience food sector did not cause that redistribution alone. Washing machines, dishwashers, supermarket consolidation, and in many countries, women's expanded participation in the formal labor force all moved together as a system, none of them the sole cause of the others. But the convenience food sector made that redistribution structurally easier. A working mother in 1980 who put a frozen lasagna in the oven at 6:45 and served dinner at 7:25 was not lazy. She was using a product that had been engineered to give her that 40 minutes back. A second concrete gain was food security at the bottom of the income distribution. Canned soup, instant noodles, bouillon cubes, powdered milk, ramen blocks, frozen vegetables, and shelf-stable starches kept calories cheap and predictable for households on tight budgets. A family living on $40 a week for groceries in 1975 could not afford the labor cost of scratch cooking, measured against the labor cost of a parent who had to be at a second job at 4 p.m. The same is true in Japan. The Redaruto curry pouch and the instant ramen block have kept millions of single-person and working-class households fed across decades. A third gain was cross-cultural availability. The supermarket aisle in a 1990s American suburb contained Japanese instant ramen, Italian canned tomatoes, Chinese soy sauce, Indian curry pastes, Mexican-style salsas, all shelf-stable, all affordable, all available in places where no member of the originating culture had ever lived. A young American cook, curious about Japanese cooking, could buy Hondashi, Mirin, and Kikkoman Shoyu without leaving the suburb. Convenience food distribution is also cross-cultural food distribution. The two cannot be separated. A fourth gain, often missed in this conversation, was accessibility for people with disability, illness, fatigue, or limited cooking ability. A person managing chronic pain, a single parent recovering from surgery, an older cook with arthritic hands, a household where no adult had been taught to cook by their own parents, for all of these, convenience food removed a barrier that scratch cooking imposed. It is not a small thing to make dinner possible when otherwise dinner would not have happened. These gains are real. They are not a defense the cooking systems reader has to make against some other case. They are the half of the trade that is too often left unspoken. What was lost? The losses are also real. They are not nostalgic losses, they are operational ones. The clearest loss was the daily practice intelligence described in the second section. Fat behavior, broth instinct, sauce by reduction, vegetable confidence. None of these were lost in some absolute sense. Every one of them is still practiced somewhere, by someone, and can be relearned from a good book or a careful teacher. What was lost was the frequency. A skill practiced 4 times a week is a different skill from one practiced 4 times a year. Most home cooks who came of age after 1980 simply did not practice these things at the daily frequency that would make them automatic. They became, instead, skills you reach for self-consciously, with a recipe, on a weekend, for company. The shift from automatic to self-conscious is the actual loss. A second loss was temporal pattern. Scratch cooking imposes a rhythm. A stock simmers for hours. A braise needs an afternoon. A fermented pickle takes weeks. The cook plans around the food's natural pace. Convenience food collapses those pacings into the cook's preferred window. 8 minutes in the microwave, 30 in the oven, 45 total from freezer to plate. The cook does not have to fit themselves around what the food needs. At the level of individual evenings, this is pure gain. Across a lifetime, the cook never develops the patience a slow food requires. Never learns to read the smell of a kitchen at hour 3 of a stock. Time is an ingredient. A frame I explore separately in How French Cooking Uses Time as an Ingredient becomes invisible. A third loss was failure recovery practice. A pan sauce breaks, you save it. A custard begins to scramble, you pull it. A stew is oversalted, you pat it with potato. Scratch cooking is, in part, a long apprenticeship in small rescues. Convenience food, by design, does not fail. It either heats correctly or does not. And if it does not, the cook throws it out and opens another package. The cook never accumulates the rescue vocabulary. When they finally try scratch cooking and the sauce breaks, they have no idea what just happened. This is one reason modern home cooks describe scratch cooking as harder than it actually is. They do not lack technique, they lack failure practice. These losses are not arguments against convenience food. They are simply the other side of the ledger. Why nostalgia is too simple. Nostalgia is a tempting frame for this material because it makes the writer sound thoughtful while letting the reader off the hook. Things were better when we cooked from scratch. The line is half true. The other half is that things were also harder, more constrained by gender, more vulnerable to a bad week, and impossible for households without the time or the help or the health to make scratch cooking the default. The honest version of the story is the trade, not the fall. What was traded was a stack of daily intelligences for a stack of time and a stack of access. Both halves of that trade were valuable. Neither half was free. The interesting question is not which half was right, but what to bring back, deliberately, now that the trade is settled enough to see clearly. Convenience food has not stopped iterating, either. The meal kit boom of the 2000s was an attempt to sell back some of the texture engineering and ingredient curation while restoring some of the cook's involvement. The current frozen prep aisle, pre-chopped mirepoix, pre-portioned proteins, frozen aromatics, is another iteration in the same conversation. The AI recipe assistant interfaces being built now are aiming at a different layer of the same trade, replacing the planning, sequencing, and substitution intelligence that used to live in the cook's head. The trade is not over. It is in motion. It always was. How to read a convenience product as cooking system history. There is a practical reading skill this article is trying to install. When you pick up a convenience product, a jar of marinara, a frozen entree, a packet of dashi powder, a box of instant pancake mix, you can ask a single, specific question. Which daily intelligence did this absorb? A jar of marinara absorbed the tomato sauce by reduction practice. The slow afternoon of canned tomatoes simmering down to viscosity, with garlic warmed in oil and salt adjusted at the end. The jar's existence is not a moral statement. it is a transfer of that practice from your kitchen to a factory. If you want the practice back, you can have it. The jar did not delete it. The jar is, in effect, a one-line summary of the practice it absorbed. A bouillon cube absorbed the stock and broth practice. A pre-rendered duck fat absorbed the fat rendering practice. A frozen mirepoix absorbed the chop and sweat practice. A jarred curry paste absorbed the spice blooming and grinding practice. None of these absorptions is theft. They are transfers made visible by the product's existence on the shelf. Reading convenience food this way changes what you do with it. It is no longer the easy option I should feel guilty about. It is a specific historical artifact that contains a specific transferred skill. A cook can use jarred marinara on Tuesday and make tomato sauce from scratch on Sunday and lose nothing by either choice, provided the Sunday version happens often enough to stay live in the hands. That is the reading skill. Every convenience product is a transferred practice. Hold both halves in mind, and the supermarket aisle stops being a moral landscape and becomes what it actually is. A history of cooking systems, laid out at eye level, free to read. Closing almost any scratch technique that the convenience aisle absorbed can be brought back into a modern weeknight kitchen without giving up the time savings the aisle made possible. A French omelet, 3 eggs, butter, salt, 90 seconds in a hot pan, is the most direct proof that scratch cooking is not slow. The whole method is at basic French omelet. A pot of dashi is 45 mostly idle minutes, 20 of which are passive soaking, less active time than a frozen lasagna. The procedure is at basic dashi. The underlying chemistry of what the industrial side of this trade was actually doing lives in the Atlas of Cooking Systems, Chapter 2 on Fat and Emulsification, and Chapter 3 on Moisture and Texture, in case the engineering is worth understanding from the inside. The convenience food hour did not disappear. It moved. The trade was complicated, it was uneven across households, and it is still in motion. The supermarket aisle is full of products carrying transferred skill. The home kitchen is full of half-remembered defaults, waiting to be practiced again. Both halves are present at once. Reading the aisle that way, as a history of cooking systems rather than a verdict, is more useful than mourning it, and more honest than celebrating it. The hour is wherever you are willing to put it. That is the only line that has been true the whole time.